By the 1860s, the island of Bermuda had spent the better part of a century gradually increasing in importance to the Royal Navy. Back in the late 1700s, it was a useful stopover point, but not much more. If the Royal Navy needed to base ships in that general area of the world, mostly to protect British holdings in the Caribbean, well, there were numerous larger and more capable harbours in the 13 colonies. However, there followed some ill-advised attempts at turning Boston Harbour into the world's largest teapot, and by the time the dust of the fallout from all of that had settled, the 13 colonies had become the United States of America, and the Royal Navy found it was considerably less welcome in its ports. Now, Bermuda's position along one of the major sailing trade routes had become somewhat more important, and so the island chain was surveyed to work out where the best place for a new naval base would be. This would allow close monitoring of, and protection of, where necessary, trade, as the Caribbean was at one end of the most important trade links in the area, but tropical zones were held as inadvisable long-term basing locations due to disease, and Halifax, although the default primary Royal Navy base in the Western Atlantic at this point, was a little bit too far north for ships on patrol to rely on as a sole location for rest and refit, whereas Bermuda, sitting at about the halfway point of the Caribbean to Europe trade route, was a perfect base. By the latter stages of the Napoleonic Wars, significant work had been undertaken to build such a base, and the island became a key location during the War of 1812 for both the Royal Navy itself, which launched the expedition that burned Washington, D.C. from there, among other things, but also for numerous privateers who ranged out against the U.S. merchant fleet. Shortly after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, Bermuda took over responsibility as the headquarters of the North America Station from Halifax, and work on the dockyard would continue over the next half century, expanding it and improving its facilities. But as the Age of Ironclads dawned, there was a problem. Older wooden warships had until relatively recently been small enough that in the event of extensive fouling to their undersides or various other issues below the waterline, you could simply careen the ship, that is, temporarily beaching it under controlled conditions to access the needed areas. Specialist careening wharves, which could replicate the necessary heel without having to have the ship entirely out of the water, had also been developed, and these were indeed in use at Bermuda. But the very largest wooden warships, as well as the new iron vessels, were both too large and too heavy for this to actually work. Plus, the heavy machinery that they now contained to drive their propellers wasn't exactly suited to being hauled over almost on its side on a semi-regular basis. And so a dry dock was needed, but after extensive surveying and several attempts to actually build one, it was concluded that this was basically an impossible task to do anywhere near the Bermuda dockyard, as the entire area was a mix of limestone and sandstone, very porous rocks that meant that water would seep in continuously if you were trying to empty it, or leak out constantly if you were trying to fill it, of course depending on the season and exactly where you were trying to build the thing relative to the local water table. Such stone also wasn't particularly strong, which meant that even if you somehow managed to seal it all, any dry dock built would probably distort itself under load over time. But such issues weren't unique. They'd been encountered in other places across the world, as well as areas where there had been a lack of space ashore, even though there might have been existing dry docks, or there may have been shallow coastal waters that prevented an approach to the shoreline itself, or just a lack of suitable ground, like at Bermuda, all of which could preclude the building of a normal dry dock. And the solution in those cases had been a floating dry dock. Various such docks, built of wood and more recently built of iron, had been put into service over the past few decades. But once again, there were a number of new challenges in Bermuda's case. Firstly, Bermuda had no great iron or shipbuilding industry capable of construction of a floating dry dock of this size, so it would have to be built in the UK, and while floating dry docks had been towed to new locations before, no one had tried towing one across an entire ocean before. Secondly, since the dry dock would have to support the largest ironclads in the Royal Navy, with scope for potentially larger ships in the future, it would have to be, by the standards of the time, absolutely massive. Third, Since Bermuda was still officially classed as tropical waters, even if not quite as disease-prone as the Caribbean, there would be a fair amount of marine growth occurring. And that meant the dry dock itself would need to be cleaned from time to time. Building a nesting doll of dry docks wouldn't solve that particular issue, and so it would have to be somewhat ship-shaped in cross-section so that it itself could be careened in order to be cleaned, as the lack of major internal machinery would allow this to be done. Fourth, since it would be based far from the industrial heart of the British Empire, it would have to accomplish all of this and its regular operations in a manner that didn't require dozens and dozens of pumps and other bits of machinery, all of which would need maintenance and inevitably have breakdowns. And what machinery it did have would need to be robust and easy to maintain, with spare parts either small enough to be easily stockpiled or simple enough to be fabricated on site. This challenge was delivered to the Campbell Johnston and Company shipyard on the Thames near Woolwich in London. Work began in 1866, and after 2 years, the new floating dry dock was in the water. It measured 381 feet long and 124 feet wide, able to take in ships with up to an 84-foot beam, with two main modes of supporting the ships once they were inside. For vessels of 330 feet or less in length, there were mobile caissons that could be placed within the dock, and then the dock was pumped out as well as being raised. This would allow full access to the ship in question without actually having to raise the dock all that much. This category covered most of the existing ironclad fleet. An example cited at the time was that of the 300-foot-long HMS Bellerophon, which would only need to be raised about 10 feet upwards instead of the 30 feet or so that would be needed without the caissons. However, there were of course some British ironclads that did exceed 330 foot in length, and for these vessels, including those that might actually be longer than the dry dock itself, the structure had enough buoyancy that when it was emptied, it could lift high enough to simply clear the hull completely from the water. In this mode, the dry dock was capable of lifting any vessel in the world at the time, with the sole exception of the Great Eastern, which, although it was 82 foot wide and thus technically able to enter the structure when it was flooded down, couldn't be lifted as the need for careening meant that the lower portion of the dry dock curved inwards faster than Brunel's massive steamship's own sides, and so it wouldn't quite fit after all. In order to raise and lower itself, the 8,200-ton structure, or 9,000 tons if you included the two caissons, was divided into 16 major watertight compartments, 8 on either side of the keel, plus various smaller non-flooding compartments which held pumps, machinery, etc. Each of the large compartments were further divided into 3, a lower compartment that would normally be at least somewhat flooded, except when exceptionally heavy lifts were called for, a middle compartment that was used to sink the dry dock entirely, and then also used to balance the dry dock before and during lifts, and an upper compartment that was normally dry but could be flooded if some circumstances happened to call for it. A great deal of the process of allowing water in and out was done by means of a series of large valves. These fulfilled the ease of maintenance requirements and meant that relatively few large and robust pumps were needed to regulate moving water out when the dry dock was being lifted, and the sinking element, if you had the time, could be done entirely under valve control. Although ready in 1868, it was almost winter when the dry dock was actually launched, and not wanting to hazard a winter voyage, it was towed down to Sheerness and flooded, where it then sat happily, mostly underwater, awaiting better weather in the spring of 1869. By May of that year, the dock was back above water and was being fitted out for sea. A pair of light wooden bridges were installed across the top to facilitate navigation. 3 powerful lights were also attached, one on the aft bridge and one on either side. Semaphore arms for signalling by day were complemented by a combination of lights, whistles and signal guns for night or fog conditions. And on each corner, a large lightning rod was installed in case of storms. A rudder was also fitted, although it wasn't known exactly how effective it would be. The voyage began on the 23rd of June 1869, with a crew of just under 90 men and one dog, with the initial tow being undertaken by half a dozen tugs on a wonderfully sunny day, one that was so glorious that one observer who was aboard the dry dock wrote that it made even Sheerness, traditionally stated to have been made up of the refuse rubbish after the rest of the world was created, look something approaching cheerful under the influence of its rays. Three small paddle sloops, HMS Wildfire, Buzzard and Medusa, accompanied the dry dock down to the Nore, with the larger paddle frigate HMS Terrible following astern with a heavy tow cable connecting her to the structure. The plan was for the Terrible to act as a giant stabilising anchor of sorts, as well as providing a degree of steering, if needed, by sailing port or starboard as required, and the tow line then dragging the aft end of the dry dock around so the structure would turn in the opposite direction to whichever direction Terrible happened to be sailing. For the purpose of the voyage, the dry dock had been fitted with a pair of cutwaters, one at each end. These were pointed iron structures, each 24 foot long and sloped on the underside, positioned just below the waterline in its travel mode. These would give the whole thing a somewhat better underwater profile in terms of both drag and directional stability. As ocean-going tugs weren't yet really a thing in the late 1860s, the large ironclad Northumberland instead had been given the task of initially taking the dry dock out to sea, joined shortly after the convoy reached the North Sea itself by another large ironclad, the Agincourt, which took position ahead of the Northumberland in a tandem tow position. At a stately speed of around about 4 knots, the line of four vessels, Agincourt, Northumberland, the dry dock, and then the Terrible, headed off down the channel, with the paddle sloops assuming a loose escort formation. The crew of the dry dock discovered they were to be quite pleased with their accommodation, as the upper sections of each of the major compartments of the hull had been fitted out as crew cabins, stores, messes, a pantry, a sick bay, and a workshop, with the great cavernous interiors providing ample room for all. The captain had a cabin built atop the starboard side of the dry dock. This was essentially a small, quickly built wooden house, with a similar structure on the port side, which served as the officer's mess, as well as accommodation for an Admiralty monitor who would keep an eye on the status of the dry dock itself. Due to the size of the dry dock and the position of these two houses, the captain found himself sleeping at about the same height as the mizzen-top mast position on the big ironclads ahead. He also had contrived to construct a small flower garden around his accommodation, although, sadly, after a few weeks at sea, the salt spray proved too much for them, and the flowers were given a full military funeral and committed to the deep. The voyage down the channel ended up being somewhat uneventful, save for semi-regular visits by various admiral ships as well as the royal yacht, all of whom seemed to want to come and take a closer look at the unusual convoy. As they approached the end of the channel, a sail was rigged inside the dry dock, that is, between the two sides, although it was drawn across more in like a massive curtain than hoisted like a sail, and it proved to be of some help when the wind got up. In this manner, the speed of the tow, at least when a decent wind was to be had, increased to around about 5 knots, with a promise of another knot or so if the wind really managed to blow hard. Once clear of the channel, it was decided to pay out the towing hawsers to full length. The original plan had been to now have Agincourt and Northumberland continue towing, but now in parallel, one on the port bow, the other on the starboard, but concern over an uneven load if the dry dock yawed, and the fact the tandem arrangement had so far done far better than expected, meant the tandem setup was maintained, just with the lines now at full extension. Crossing the Bay of Biscay afforded a chance to exceed 6 knots as a thunderstorm broke, with the paddle sloops swapping out with new ones along both this leg of the voyage as well as the previous voyage down the channel. The initial destination was Madeira, a planned stopover which would address any issues that might have arisen along the way, and allowing an exchange of towing ships, as Northumberland and Agincourt were two of the largest and most recent warships in the Royal Navy, and so couldn't afford the time to go all the way to Bermuda them themselves when their normal assignment was considerably closer to home. On the 4th of July, Madeira was sighted and the Agincourt parted company, slowing the procession somewhat, but they still arrived at Porto Santo by around 1400, with nothing having gone particularly wrong along the way except for a few very minor leaks which had left the bow down by an inch or so, a situation that was fairly quickly remedied by the ship's pumps. Here, the Northumberland transferred its tow lines to HMS Warrior, while the dock itself was swarmed by locals, who were permitted to step off of their boats and wander around the base of the dry dock freely, with the sailors then placing bets on the capabilities of those who attempted to visit the upper levels by means of the various ladders that had been placed up the inner sides of the dry dock for that purpose. Soon, Warrior was joined by her sister ship Black Prince, and by 2000 that evening, the tow was recommenced. Although some merriment was had when the starboard line that attached Terrible to the aft end of the dock parted, and the paddle frigate found itself swinging back and forth on the end of the other line as the broken line was dealt with. It was eventually replaced the following day. By this point, only the small screw-driven HMS Lapwing was left as an escort, with the main entertainment being provided by the ship's band aboard Warrior, which merrily played a variety of tunes and were generally agreed to be somewhat more skilled than those in a similar position aboard the Northumberland. Further amusement was to be found when somebody contrived to float a buoy and line back from Warrior, which was then taken aboard the dry dock and attached to a pulley higher up. This then became a means by which various bits of correspondence could be hauled quickly and easily between the ships, and at one stage a large haunch of mutton was mysteriously sent over from the ironclad, to the general joy of all aboard the dry dock. Further mysterious and unannounced food packages from the presumably sympathetic wardroom aboard Warrior would show up at occasional points during the voyage. As the convoy crossed the Atlantic, fishing lines were put out whenever flying fish were spotted, on the theory that they were jumping out of the water because they were presumably trying to escape from something that was following them, and that something might be big enough to be worth eating. This scheme had varying levels of success, although an early catch of a small tuna was greatly appreciated by all, who pronounced it very tasty. On the 8th of July, at about 19:45 in the evening, there was a great crashing noise. This turned out to be the port side rudder chain, which had worked its way free of its lashings with the continuous rolling of the ship. One of the small boilers aboard the dry dock was brought up to steam, and a capstan was then used to gradually haul the chain back into place, where it was resecured, the whole process taking several hours and meriting all involved an additional rum ration. The dry dock's rudder would prove to be somewhat temperamental in rougher seas, and soon the chains and the rudder itself was further secured for the safety of all concerned. Examination the following day showed that the dry dock was rolling slower and to a lesser degree than the three ships with her, the ships recording 9 rolls per minute, with a minimum roll of 4 to 5 degrees and a maximum roll of 10, while the dry dock rolled only 8 times per minute with a minimum roll of 2.5 degrees and a maximum of 5. Due to the Lapwing struggling with the sea conditions and burning far too much coal in an attempt to station keep, on the 18th, Terrible was ordered to the front of the formation, taking up lines to tow Black Prince, which in turn was towing Warrior, which in turn was towing the dry dock, with Lapwing then taking up Terrible's former position as the dry dock's sometime sea anchor. Rough weather slowed progress from around 120 miles a day to around 90 to 100 for a few days, although this was somewhat offset by the same weather producing several rare lunar rainbows, which everybody thought looked quite cool. However, by the 25th, it was clear that the Terrible hadn't really added all that much to the convoy's speed. It was simply burning far more coal than she had been previously for her efforts, so she was ordered to proceed alongside for a while as the escort, since Lapwing was still in Terrible's former position aft, and the latter was better suited to keeping up with the rest of the ships working independently. However, later that same day, a storm blew up, and Lapwing's smaller mass meant that she was unable to prevent the dry dock slewing sideways into the wind, and so by the end of the day she had swapped places with Terrible, thus re-establishing the original formation. It was determined that they were at this point only a few days away from Bermuda, and so the Warrior and Black Prince increased power to their engines, using some of the reserve of coal they had kept aside previously for emergencies, and Lapwing was sent on ahead to herald their arrival. Now conscious that their voyage would soon be over, the dry dock sail was de-rigged and the anchors prepared and checked. The Bermuda lighthouse was spotted on the morning of Wednesday the 28th of July, and the plan had originally been for the two ironclads to cast off and for Terrible to tow the dock through the narrows and into the harbour. But a combination of rapidly shifting winds and a 2-knot current caused a mess of confusion that eventually left the dry dock spinning gently as it bobbed towards a nearby island while the ships tried to sort themselves out. Luckily, Warrior came to the rescue, sent lines over to the Terrible, and with the extra power available thanks to Warrior, the dock was brought to heel and towed to the mouth of the final channel, where the ironclad cast off once again as the channel at this stage was far too shallow for her to proceed. In these calmer waters, it was hoped that Terrible would manage, but unfortunately, the paddle frigate was completely unable to keep the dry dock both moving and pointed in the right direction. One or the other was possible, but not both. And so they waited outside the harbour overnight for the following morning's high tide, which meant Warrior could now safely sail down the channel, which she did with Terrible in tow, and with Terrible in turn having the dry dock in tow. Two gunboats and a tug came out to meet them, and the tug took Warrior's place, while the gunboats were made fast to either side of the dock. There then followed an adventurous final passage up the narrow deep water channel, as the lines attaching the gunboats to the dock kept giving way, and bursts of unexpected wind kept trying to spin the thing around. But eventually at 17:15, the anchors were dropped, thus ending a 36-day voyage. A few days later, the dry dock's valves were opened and it was fully flooded, bringing it to rest on the harbour bed. And here, she would continue to give good service for the rest of the 19th century, lifting a large variety of ships, both mercantile and Royal Navy, and a few foreign warships into the bargain. But by the start of the 20th century, some newer ships were getting a bit beyond her capacity to lift, and a new floating dry dock was constructed and sent out to supplement and eventually replace her, with the new dry dock arriving in 1902. And thus, in 1906, she was deemed surplus to requirements, decommissioned, and sold for breaking up. But the original floating dry dock decided she rather liked her new home, and so it broke free and ran aground almost the moment it had left the harbour. Thus stuck in place and showing very little inclination to move further, an attempt to blow it up with dynamite ended up doing surprisingly little damage, and so it was just left to break up in place on its own, with a fairly good portion of the lower section still visible to this day if you happen to be in Bermuda.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.